Hi there, I'm Edwina Farley. This is A Big Country on RN. This week, a hunt for bush tucker sweetens relationships between police and Indigenous youth in northwest Queensland. We'll juggle rocks building a stone wall in Tasmania, meet Richard Tomkin, the Grevillea King, and we'll head down to the wharf in Cairns in far north Queensland, where Nadine Adams is busy unloading tiger prawns. This former Londoner has been working the prawn boats for years now, rising up the ranks from cook to deckie, and now she's first mate.
It does break a lot of people. I've seen grown men cry. You know, a lot of people come on and they try their hardest, but they're just not cut out for it. And then, we have to go and drop them off or whatever. There's only the few that actually come back season after season and enjoy the work.
And she's definitely one of them. She even has plans to go for her skipper's licence. Life on a prawn trawler later in the show. But let's start our travels today with a trek through the bush in northwest Queensland.
Hi, I'm Uncle Peter, and we're going hunting for sugar bug.
It's mid-morning, but already the temperature is creeping over 40 degrees. It's a hot day to go looking for native sugar bag honey, but Peter Parlow isn't deterred. He's a one-year Garawa man, skilled in finding bush tucker and bush medicine. And he's leading this group out into the bush, not far from the border town of Camelwheel in northwest Queensland.
Is sugar bag something you eat? Like, is it for a special occasion or just like an everyday food?
Everyday food, I suppose you can say.
Any special kind of recipes that you do with it?
Not really, just like a sweet, you know?
Good enough just as it is.
Yeah, that's it.
G'day, I'm Zara Margolis. Today's expedition has been organised by the local police sergeant as a way of engaging with local Indigenous youth. Usually they bond over sport, but today it's all about finding bush tucker, specifically the sugar bag honey that's produced by little stingless bees.
We'll look for the best tree, pollen tree, and then you just have a look. And if you see a bee coming out, that's your sugar bag.
When you say a hollow tree, what type of tree are we talking about?
Well, bloodwood tree and the ghost gum, or snappy gum we call them in this country.
And the bees, what do they look like?
Look like fly.
How do you tell the difference?
Easy. You don't have many flies in the tree, you know, coming out of the hole of the hive. Yeah. So that's how you know there's a sugar bag bee. You just got to look. Like a dead branch like that?
Yep.
You'll find them, yeah. Or just a hole. They'll make their own little hole. They know when it's hollow, the bee itself, they'll make a home there, didn't? And all the way down, they just make their own little hive all the way, just like the American bee. And yeah, they make their own hive and just cut the tree and you'll find him.
And then it kind of oozes out when you kind of cut it open.
Yeah, you cut him. But if you cut him right, it won't spill out.
Okay.
You cut him just right and then you've got to scoop it out.
So there's a skill to it.
Yeah, there's a skill to it. That's him.
But it's not just sugar bag honey that interests Peter Parlow. As we scour the trees looking for the telltale signs of the honeybees, it gives us a quick rundown of what some of the other trees and plants in this area can be used for.
Can see that tree there? Make stick out of it, like fighting stick they make, or the clap stick. Yeah.
What's the properties? Is it quite like a strong tree?
It's a strong tree, yeah. Flexible one too, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes spear, you can make spear from if you get the best, you know, straight one. And then you do it in the fire to make them straight. And see this here, ladies? A little black fruit, like the berries, you know?
Mm.
Real nice one there, when they come in season. This teaches a bit of story about, you know, when you got wart on your hand or finger, you know, the wart, You get this here. Look, see this, there's thorn on it. You get four of them and you just poke it and then snap it and leave it in there and just kill it.
Really?
Go away. Yeah.
What's it got in it?
Oh, I'm not too sure, but it kills wart.
And you just need four of those little thorns?
Just four of those thorns, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Congerberry. And the roots itself?
Yeah.
Good for toothache. Congerberry tree.
While we've been busy learning about bush medicine, the call goes out. One of the younger blokes with us on the trip, Roderick Mahoney, has spied some stingless bees and has found the hive.
I found one over there where Singy's singing at.
Oh, nice. So how'd you find it?
Now we just found
bee.
Yeah, some bee and the wax. like they make a little circular wax, sand it in here, like we hear it. We hear if we got some in there and hear them little bees in there. Yeah. See some of them coming out too. We just know that it had something in there and that's about it, eh?
So show me where you...
It's right about here, eh? Like we found the wax, it was there. Seen some bit of it coming out.
Put your ear to that.
Put your ear. Yeah, sorry. You can hear it if you like. Yeah. Put your ears there.
Put your ear to that.
Yeah, they're working. Hard working.
Yeah. Hot day like this.
Oh yeah, I can hear it.
And someone like marked it here.
So you already cut. You already cut.
Yeah,
right?
Somebody cut him before, and they're gonna try have a look if any in there. Now.
Yeah. I reckon they'll have it down here all somewhere.
Right. So now is a crucial thing. Is now.
You just gotta start.
He's gonna start chopping.
Yeah.
Alright, let's go. Tape 1, 2.
Watching on as Broderick and his mates start chopping at the tree is Sergeant Amit Singh, the officer in charge of the Camelwheel Police Station. Since he arrived to take up his post in mid-2017, he's made a point of forging a good relationship with the local community, and going on country is part of it.
It's always good to engage people on their things they know. So I bring sports and they bring their culture and we put it together to build a better relationship with police and the community.
What do you remember the first time you came out and did this?
First time when I came out, it was an experience because it's not just looking for the thing. Then you gotta cut the tree and you gotta cut it in a specific way, like you can see what they're doing at the moment, and you gotta shave it. It's a lot of hard work to get to the honey, but when you get to it, it's pretty awesome feeling. There's a lot of hard work and there's a lot of and I've got a lot to learn, and these fellas are teaching me. See, I take time to help them with other things and they take time to teach me their culture. As a police officer, for me it's better to engage people in things that they enjoy and they make me part of it, and I get to get them involved in the things that I enjoy. And so it's a good relationship.
After some deft work with the axe, the honey is revealed. It's protected in the tree hollow by a waxy surround, hence the name sugar bag honey.
Here, look.
Honey.
Taste.
Have a eat, boys.
You have a eat.
Wow,
look at it all.
Can't we?
So the reason they're called sugar bag is because they're in the bag. See, like, you open that up. So you rip that out, and see it's inside the bag.
Oh wow!
So yeah, pull it out.
That's crazy.
The bag itself is wax, so you don't eat that. You just suck the honey out.
And then throw the wax away.
Yeah. Otherwise, get stuck to your teeth.
Wow! Does it taste good? As 9-year-old Ray Ray will tell you, in between licking her sticky fingers, finding sugar bag honey is well worth the effort. Next time I'm in the bush, I'll keep my eyes peeled for those little stingless bees.
Whoa, there's more down there.
What we're doing is you just pick up a stone that you want to fit tight against the next stone, and you've got a sort of level between each stone so you can break your joints so that you don't end up with running joints up through your wall. Yeah, and so you're trying to make you sort of look random, but it's not random, there's a process to it.
It's a bit like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Piles of rocks in all shapes and sizes and even colours that will come together over time to form a beautiful stone wall. It's not a fast job. Stonemason John Boland needs to carefully consider the placement of each and every rock to make sure it's going to look just right.
Yeah, we just take the stones, and if they've got waves, if sometimes they've got bumps and waves on them, so we chip those off so that they don't stick out of the wall too far.
Hello, I'm Larissa Smith. John and his offsider are working on this building site near Hadsbin in Tasmania's northeast.
Yeah, we're trying to get a sort of a uniform 10mm joint of mortar between each stone so it looks nice and neat.
Do you think you've developed an eye for exactly what stone goes where you've been doing this?
You do, you get better at it. You still got to think all the time. It's one of those jobs it doesn't look like we're thinking much, but you've got to, at the end of the day, you're mentally tired more than physically tired, because you've got to think all day about which stone, how high it's going to be and what shape it's going to be.
And you're working with some different colours as well here with the rocks that have been quarried from the farm.
Yeah, some of them come out of the quarry and they're a bit lighter brown, and some of them were picked off roads and fence lines and things, so they're a bit darker. Some of them have got bits of lichen on them, but so you sort of got to mix the colours up so you don't have all light stones and all dark stones. You've got to try not to have too many chipped stones so we don't have a bit of blue, too much blue in one patch. So you've got to mix that up a bit too. Even though they're irregular stones, there is a process to how they go together. You've got a set of rules of how a stone has to sit and be laid so that it looks uniform right around the house and looks consistent. And because there's two of us working on it, I've got to have a set of a way that the stone's laid so that Tony's lays them the same as me, so it looks similar, which can be hard if you've got more than quite a few people working on a house, stonemasons. It can be hard to get that consistency right through the wall.
John works as a stonemason now, but he's not always been looking at rocks. He and his partner moved to Tasmania after a stint in New South Wales working in the forestry industry. How different is this job to what you were doing some 10 years ago back in New South Wales?
New South Wales, I was working for prospectus forestry companies, and yeah, that was just more managing people. Well, it was sort of more horticultural work, managing people driving tractors and spray rigs and ripping tractors and irrigation crews and things. It's totally different, really. I like it's a lot easier. Must be smoko time. He always barks at smoko time. When we finished up in forestry, my partner Danielle and I just wanted a break, and I really wanted to do work with my hands, a trade of some sort. So we went travelling around Australia to find where we'd move to. And we came back to Tassie because Tassie was the spot that we liked the most. It had the best climate and the nicest people. Yeah, and it was just the first job I got into was labouring for a stonemason. And that's how he came to be here.
John doesn't just work with his hands building stone walls. He and his partner have also realised their dream to buy a small property here in Tasmania. So he's now juggling work as a stonemason with everyday farm work.
Always wanted to buy land and have and just grow cows or crops. But we couldn't really afford to when we first moved to Tassie, because the banks don't really like young couples that don't have a lot of backing or equity. So we wanted to buy a farm back there 10, 13 years ago, but we couldn't. So it's just come to the stage in the last 4 or 5 years that we've been able to buy a place and get some cows. And I really enjoy farming. It's probably similar to stonework, as you, at the end of each day, you can look back and see you've achieved something, whether you're growing cows or ploughing a paddock or something. You get a satisfaction out of achieving something at the end of each day. So it's similar in that way, and I like that.
Stonemason John Boland there, enjoying working with his hands in northern Tasmania. You're listening to A Big Country on RN. Coming up, life for a woman working in the male-dominated prawn trawling industry. And you get to meet Bundaberg's Grevillea King, Richard Tompkin.
I've been collecting and grafting and breeding them for 35 years, roughly. So I probably know quite a bit more than a lot of people about it, but there's going to be some other people out there that know different angles, and we're willing to talk.
Richard Tompkin's life has been taken over by an Australian native plant. For more than 3 decades, he's been collecting, grafting and breeding grevilleas for the home gardener. You might even have some growing in your yard. Do names like Billy Bonkers, Super Duper or Flamingo ring a bell? Hello, I'm Brad Marcellus. Richard is known as the Grevillea King of Australia. I've tracked him down to his home near Bundaberg in Queensland to find out how a visit to his mum's house became an obsession.
I came down from Darwin in about 82 to my place I had out towards Gingin. And I went to my mother's place in Gingin. She had a plant called a honey gem, which most people know about, and a Robin Gordon and a Ned Kelly and a coconut ice. And I thought, wow, these are fantastic. I'll go and buy some. And I found I couldn't. they just weren't readily available. So at that stage I said, well, I'll try and propagate them myself, which I did achieve. And then I started collecting grevilleas. And then after I got about 40 or 50, I found that the ones I really wanted came from Western Australia. And they just won't survive on their own roots over here. So I moved to grafting.
So tell me about this grafting process. I can see some little seedlings or young plants there. And they've sort of got a little bit of sort of sticky tape or something around them. Is that right? Tell me about the process. I've dumbed it down there. Let's hear from the Grevillea King how it's really done.
Basically, all my plants are grafted onto Silky Oaks, the Grevillea Robusta. It'll handle wet feet. It'll handle all the diseases and rots that go. Whereas the piece on the top won't. So what we basically do is you wound the rootstock, that's the silky oak, and you wound the scion, which is the piece you want, and then you whack them together, bind them together with a special tape called parafilm, and then you keep them moist for days, weeks, sometimes months. I've had some after 6 months decided to grow, and then they hopefully take neatly, strongly, and there you have it. You then have a Western Australian species growing on an Eastern Australian silky oak.
What do you love about the grevillea? What really speaks to you about it as a plant?
Maintenance, size, colour. You can get them from ground covers, which are only 10 centimetres tall by 4, 5, 6 metres across. You can get them to the silky oak, which will be 30 metres tall. Anywhere in between those two, you could have any colour except blue. You can say that within reason, you prune them once, twice a year. They attract birds by the million. Yeah, what more do you want?
Now, you have referred to some of these as your children, of your children. We never have favourite children, do we? We're not allowed to say that, but no. You must. Tell me a bit about one of your favourites.
No, I can't. I can't. The very first one that we put out was one called Billy Bonkers, and it's called Billy Bonkers, not for any rude reason, but because we had a dog called Billy, and he used to urinate on it frequently, and he turned out to be quite nuts. So that was Billy Bonkers.
So they are tough then.
Oh, they're tough. Yeah, they don't mind a bit of urea. That's one of the things that you can add to grevilleas to make them grow well, but what you mustn't do is add phosphorus. So people don't chuck chicken manure around. It's quite lethal for them in quantity.
So how many hybrids have you come up with in your 30-plus years?
Well, there's about 20-something out there at the moment, but there's another 10 or 15 to come, so 35, 40. And it's not an easy job. It sounds like it must be, but you just got to work on it day by day by day. And then you've got to be ruthless when they come up, that you say, nah, that's the wrong colour. Oh. No, it doesn't work properly. Oh, this is too prickly, etc., etc., etc. Or, just don't like it, throw it away.
So it is a bit of a waiting game as well. It's like, again, like children, you got to wait till they grow up to see what they're going to turn out like.
And then you throw them away.
So you got to wait a little bit for the plant to mature before you know exactly what you're getting?
4 or 5 years.
Whoa.
So if you've got, there's one up there which is perhaps a bit more favourite called Super Duper. It's a tiny plant. It's less than a metre tall. It's about a metre round. It flowers all year. It's got soft foliage. It's a gorgeous little thing. But that is a cross between a cross and a cross and a cross. I think it's 5 generations back from the first cross. Then you recross that with something else, and then the progeny from that, you select the one you want and then redo it again with something else, and then redo it again, and then finally, if you're lucky, you get what you want.
Wow.
So that was one seed out of 3, and that's all we got. And the other 2 were rubbish. So there he is.
Well, I better be careful where I urinate. I might end up with a grevillea named after me.
Yeah, you could. You also back into some of them. They're extremely prickly. And you might just be screaming and shouting for a few minutes.
It does break a lot of people. I've seen grown men cry. You know, a lot of people come on and they try their hardest, but they're just not cut out for it. And then, we have to go and drop them off or whatever. There's only the few that actually come back season after season and enjoy the work.
You definitely notice Nadine Adams on the wharf at Cairns in far north Queensland. She's one of the few women who's made it in the male-dominated prawn trawling industry. At the moment, she and the crew are busy unloading tiger prawns after more than 100 days at sea. Hello, I'm Renee Clough. Nadine is first mate on board the FV Ocean Thief, and she's not afraid of hard physical work.
Well, I've definitely got muscles that I never used to have, but not looking too butch, so that's okay. But yeah, like, one of the most physical things is that, you know, we work long hours, especially in a banana season, for example. We may not have had too much sleep, and then we may have to go straight in and unload the product that we've got because our freezer's full. So that means we might be unloading 30 ton of prawns. And although there's conveyors and things that help you, we are manually lifting the boxes, each box out, and putting it onto a conveyor. And you can imagine what 30 tons of prawns looks like. And kind of three or four people down there doing it, it can be really strenuous. So it's about the determination and the stamina you have, just about getting the job done, not letting the fatigue get to you, and still working as a team together. Yeah, you have to be a certain kind of mindset to do it, I think.
This former Londoner has been working the prawn boats in Northern Australia for a few years now, rising up the ranks from cook to deckie and now first mate. And she has plans to climb the ladder even further and become a skipper in the Austral Fisheries fleet.
Basically, you work underneath the skipper. You have to be in control of the deck, processing of the products, and basically making sure that everything's organised as it should be, because obviously the skipper's in the wheelhouse most of the time, so I'm the person down on the deck making sure things happen the way they should be.
How difficult was that transition from cook to first mate?
Wasn't too difficult for me, I didn't find. I think it's more about the kind of traits you have as a person, more than anything. I was kind of itching to move on from the cook's position. I'd kind of done it for a couple of years and kind of learned what I could there. And it was more the progression moving on to working with the boys and having to keep up with them, as it were. But I didn't find that too hard either. But
even if you do have those attributes, that stamina, that determination, are the opportunities there for women in the fishing industry?
I think more so now than ever. Austral Fisheries have definitely helped me along the way. They've encouraged me to do what I'm doing now. They're encouraging me to, you know, expand my education further. They like me to do the skipper ticket. It's still a lot harder for a woman, even making the transition from a cook onto the deck as a deckie. You have to really prove yourself, and you know, there won't be people sticking their hands up to take a girl on. Unless they know who you are, what you do, how you are. You know, you've already proved yourself in some way. But there are women coming through, but not very many, unfortunately. But I think that's also, you know, it's the girls out there that aren't actually going and doing these kind of jobs in the first place. If you're not going to give it a try in the first place, then there's not going to be many girls doing it.
What advice would you have for girls who perhaps would like to do it?
Be focused on what you want to do. Don't worry about what other people say. I found that a lot of the guys here have that stereotypical view of women, even though they are young and, you know, they have their own minds and stuff. And I think it's that old school mentality that people are still trying to break through for women doing all different jobs in Queensland. But if people aren't willing to go through that and do it, then that won't change.
Adding to the challenge for Nadine Adams is the fact that the skipper of the Ocean Thief also happens to be her partner. Robbie Phillips admits he initially had some reservations about having Nadine as his second in command, but says it's worked out well.
It takes a lot of the aggression out of the boat, and saying that, Nadine's probably one of the most aggressive people on the boat, and that's why she's so good at her job, you know. It's the kind of job where you don't take no from anybody. To change the attitudes of a male-dominated industry, they definitely have to prove themselves to everybody, and it can be quite daunting for a male on the boat when you have such an assertive female to try and match that.
Do the blokes have to sort of, you know, inhibit their swearing a little bit, that type of thing?
Not at all. Nadine has got the worst gutter mouth out of a lot of us.
The skipper of the Ocean Thief, Robbie Phillips, speaking about his first mate and partner, Nadine Adams, who clearly has no problems matching it with the blokes. Don't forget, you can read more about our stories at any time. Just head to the RN homepage and find A Big Country under the Programs tab. You can also listen to us anytime. Check out the ABC Listen app or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. I'm Edwina Farley. We're back next week with more great stories from around Australia.